This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 10th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 307. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, the 43rd annual Terry Fox Run is September 17th. Where are you going to run, walk, or roll in memory of the Pride of Port Coquitlam to help end cancer? My guest is Bill Vickers, author of the new book, Terry and Me, the inside story of Terry Fox's Marathon of Hope. Here, part one of my interview with Terry Fox's wingman from the summer of 1980, the Summer of Hope. March 6th, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau bows to pressure from a steady parade of newspaper headlines about China's interference in Canadian elections and announces he'll hire a special rapporteur to get to the bottom of it. June 9th, former Governor General David Johnston quits as special rapporteur 2 weeks after recommending there be no public inquiry because of too much secret documents and too little evidence implicating China. Opposition leaders renewed their calls for a public inquiry and said that Johnston was in a conflict of interest. September 7th, after a summer of negotiations behind closed doors, Public Safety Minister Dominic LeBlanc announced that Quebec Appeal Court Judge Marie-Josée Hogue will run a public inquiry into the 2019 and 2021 elections. She must file a first report on February 29th, 2024, and a final report on December 31st, 2024. Here is LeBlanc.
Why was the decision made to broaden the scope of the inquiry, to not look specifically at China or exclusively at China, but to look at other actors as well?
So we have said since we formed the government that foreign interference in Canadian democratic institutions is unacceptable. We have put in place, and you've heard me in the House of Commons, and you may hear me again in the coming weeks, remind you of the important measures we stood up. But we have also acknowledged that China is not the only foreign actor that seeks to undermine democratic institutions in Canada or other Western democracies. This challenge is not unique to Canada. I had a conversation in June with the responsible British minister who talked to me about some of the very challenges they're having. So this is a global challenge for democracies. China is not the only country that seeks to interfere in an inappropriate way. And we wanted the Commission and Justice Hogue to have the ability to follow the evidence, to, as she is brought up to date by our intelligence agencies, as she hears from witnesses, as she discovers that other countries beyond China are also seeking to undermine democratic institutions in Canada and around the world, that she be free to follow that evidence. So we did not want to restrict it to one country alone, and we specifically said in those terms of reference that were agreed to, again, by all of the opposition parties, China, Russia, other state actors and non-state actors, because some of the interference may be by non-state actors that are affiliated with some of these regimes in various ways. So we wanted her to have the independent judgment to follow the evidence and to give Canadians the benefit of her conclusions.
Kenny Chu is the former Conservative MP for Steveston Richmond East, whose 2021 defeat to Liberal Parham Baines is widely believed to be the result of a campaign by Chinese Communist Party followers. According to CSIS, diplomat Tong Chao-Ling even boasted about helping defeat Chu.
Overall, I'm concerned that there will not be enough time and focus in getting to the bottom of this. The Canada elections, the Commission of Canada Elections, they have conducted investigations based on a formal complaint. They have been looking into this for over a year and a half, almost 2 years now, and yet they have still not concluded. And this is only one writing. You know, so whether the commissioner of foreign interference would be able to finish all the work in the small 5 months time frame, you know, with an expanded scope. I'm really worried that she may not be able to do as a thorough job that the problem deserves her attention.
Public inquiries are tricky animals. Quebec's Charbonneau Commission about construction corruption resulted in charges and convictions for corrupt politicians and executives. BC's Cullen Commission into money laundering resulted in no charges. In fact, Justice Austin Cullen downplayed the role of China in real estate, casinos, and drugs. So which way will the Ho Commission go? Stay tuned. TheBreaker.news will keep you posted. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast.
There are 25 million people who live in Canada. Don't tell me that we can't raise $25 million from the public of Canada. Don't tell me that. See, I got to set my goals high because I believe in miracles and I have to. Thank you.
Sunday, September 17th, is the 43rd annual Terry Fox Run. Go to terryfox.org to find where you can run, walk, or roll to raise money to end cancer in memory of Terry Fox. Joining me on the podcast is Bill Viggers, author of Terry and Me, published by Sutherland House. Canadians have gone through a lot over the decades, and it's become a divided country in so many ways. But one thing that unites Canadians is the love for the late, great Terry Fox and the drive to carry on his memory, his marathon of hope, to raise money to beat cancer. Bill Viggers was dispatched by his boss at the Canadian Cancer Society to join Terry's team in progress in 1980 in New Brunswick. Bill did not know it at the time, but he had joined the most important road trip in Canadian history. Here is the first part of my two-part feature interview with Bill Viggers, author of Terry and Me. Bill was there, right there in the van, on the road during that summer of 1980, the summer of hope, as he calls it. Now, you were working for the Canadian Cancer Society in Ontario when you met Terry. You became the wingman or the wagon master. You weren't there at the very start, April 12th, 1980. There was the Outer Cove Beach in Newfoundland, where two bottles of Atlantic Ocean water were collected. But you joined up a few months later, June 9th, 1980, in New Brunswick. Recall that first day, of your first day on the Marathon of Hope with Terry.
Bob, I had flown overnight from Toronto. I knew very little about Terry. I had spoken to him on the phone several times, and those were the days. There was no cell phone. There was no internet. So he would go to a payphone and call me, collect. And the Cancer Society sent me down to find out, is this guy for real? And the other thing is he had been passing up on his medical checkups. So the other reason they sent me down was to lay down the law, which you'll find out in the book. I chose not to. I got there at four, but I got there actually about 2:30 in the morning. I knew the guys were going to be up at four. So I just climbed in the back of my car, covered myself with a piece of plastic from a suit coat. And 4 o'clock in the morning, the lights come on, the door is open, out steps Doug and Daryl and Terry's brother and Terry. And Doug was the first one. He looked at me and as I'm playing out of the backseat of the car, and they were used to dealing, I was 33 at the time, and they were used to dealing with older gentlemen, you know, long coats and fedoras and suits and ties, and there I am in my jeans and t-shirt, and Doug looks at me and said, "You're the guy from the Cancer Society?" And I said, "Well, I hope I'm not a disappointment." And that's how it started, and we had a short visit, and then we jumped in the van. I left the car at the motel and I drove with him in the dark out the Trans-Canada Highway. And the Trans-Canada Highway at that part, I don't know what it's like now, but it was a two-lane highway and hardly any traffic on the road at that time of the day. Just the odd transport truck going by. And every time it went by, as we parked on the side of the road, Terry was getting out. the first truck goes by and it completely shakes the van. And I can remember that morning for the first 4 or 5 hours, basically that's all that's on the road is transport trucks. And every time they go whizzing by, shake the van. And I'm worried about Terry because he's running in the darkness. And we let him out. He gets out, steps on something that's been buried in the ground. And it was a white plastic bag. And every day, Doug had to pull up exactly to that spot so Terry could open the door, put his foot on it to say that he did not take one shortcut. When we were in an urban area, he would use a telephone pole or a fire hydrant and do exactly the same thing. Go over and touch it to start the morning and then continue on from there. My first 2 or 3 hours were just sat in amazement, first in the darkness. I can remember, there are so many things of the run burnt in my mind, but that morning, looking in the rearview mirror as he's running towards the van, and you can't see anything until a vehicle comes and lights him up from behind. So I'm watching this silhouette come towards me, and he just floats past the van, doesn't stop. And we pull ahead to another mile because Doug would mark each mile. And Daryl got out with the jug of water and a glass of water, and Terry come up, had a glass of water. Nobody said anything. It's too damn early in the morning, for one thing. And off he goes. And I was in absolute awe from the very first moment I watched him run. And I think everybody was. Anybody that saw him run by in person, where maybe standing that morning at the end of a concession road or on University Ave in Toronto, doesn't matter where you were, and you saw Terry run by, it was a moment of several feelings. There's a story about in the book about a man and a woman standing, and they both went on to become Terry Fox run organizers. And as Terry ran past them that day, and that was in London, he writes about how he noticed that as he ran by, he had a big smile on his face. The guys and the woman was sobbing and crying. And he realized at that moment that Terry brought out different emotions in people. She saw the pain and the effort that he was putting in. He did too, but what he saw was hope and goodness in the world. And I think that's one of the things that Terry brought that people don't realize and talk about that I experienced that summer.
But to run a marathon every day as he did, what was his breakfast? I mean, he talks about him having a glass of water, but what did he have for breakfast? What did he do to fuel himself up?
Breakfast and dinner in particularly. Lunch was usually a clubhouse sandwich and fries and a milkshake and maybe a hamburger. But breakfast was, we used to joke, Terry would order everything on the left side of the menu, and his buddy Doug would never order because he'd eat whatever Terry didn't finish, which wasn't very much. So he'd have bacon and eggs, pancakes, toast, a hamburger, a milkshake, a pop, a piece of pie. It took a lot to keep the engine burning. And dinner was basically the same thing, but even more. And there was a lot of carbs, a lot of spaghetti. You know, he ate a ton of food, and we made fun of him about it. And it was an ongoing joke with us about how much food he would eat. And people would sit in the restaurant. I remember one time he ordered food in a restaurant, and the waitress turned around and walked away thinking he was ordering food for the entire table. And it was just what he was ordering. So he was a man of good humor. And I think that's another thing people are going to read in this book is what a wonderful sense of humor he had, that he was just a regular guy. And that's what I tried to portray in the book.
And then there was the van, the Ford Econoline van, which also became a symbol. What was it like to be in that van throughout that summer?
That was Terry's refuge. Very few people got in it or rode in it. I would say a handful, maybe 5 or 6 people through the entire run. It smelled horrible, by the way. You have to realize before he gets to Ontario, and then even then, there's 3 guys sleeping in it. It's full of their dirty clothes, the sweat from both of them running, all of them are running. And the facilities, if you want to call them that, were nothing more than a tiny little space by the back door, with a bench with a hole cut in it and a plastic bowl. And there was the running competition between whose turn was it to dump it, Daryl or Doug's. And again, much humor surrounded that. People didn't want to. It was interesting. People would walk up to it, and they'd, as soon as they stuck their head into it, they'd kind of pull back. And as we got into southern Ontario that summer, it was an incredibly hot, humid summer. So all of us, you got to remember, there's four guys running. We're running along collecting money, and the kids, my kids were 8 and 9 at the time, and they were with us for much of the run. Well, you change your shirt. We had boxes and boxes of the Terry Fox shirts. And you probably, you know, changed your shirt 3 or 4 times, all of us 3 or 4 times a day, and you just threw it into the van. And it could be a week before anybody came by to offer to do our laundry. So it was a refuge for Terry. He loved it. Every morning he almost cocooned himself in a sleeping bag as he was driving out to the run. Terry didn't jump out of bed every morning going, wow, I want to go and run a marathon. It was hard for him. It was hard to get up. And then a couple of times during the run, people booked him at more than one event, which means he didn't get supper and he didn't get his right sleep, which led him to be irritable. By the way, the first movie, which was the one that had Robert Duvall in it, portrayed Terry as this angry young man, angry at having cancer. That was so far from the truth, a completely inaccurate portrayal of him. He wasn't angry. He'd get angry at us. And that was usually over him coming. He's running a marathon a day, and he runs up to the van, and we're supposed to have water and oranges ready for him. And we're in the middle of a water fight, throwing buckets of water at each other. And of course, he'd come up and yell at us, you know, you guys only got one job. And there's a wonderful scene in the movie where you don't see the argument, but you do see Daryl pouring him glasses of water. And if you knew what was going on, just 30 seconds before you're watching that, he was yelling at us. Well, 30 seconds later, he's filling his glass up with water, and I'm off screen. And next time you watch the documentary, the scenes in every documentary, Terry takes a sip and for some reason just seems to throw it away. Well, what he's doing is he's trying to hit me with the water just off screen, at which he was being successful, which I let him do because it made him laugh. And it was difficult for him to run, but at the same time, there was much levity on many days. Not all days. Some were a grind.
Now, to get through the grind, he developed his own milestones, basically to keep his mind fresh and to keep going, to endure. And one of them was basically running from telephone pole to telephone pole, that he wasn't thinking of the full distance across the country. It was get to the telephone pole, the next telephone pole, the next one, the next one, the next one.
That's exactly. People would ask him, you know, how do you run a marathon every day? He said just exactly what you said. I don't. I run to that pole, and then I run to the next pole. And there was another thing, even stronger, that kept him going. And he said it on more than one occasion. People would say, doesn't it hurt? Aren't you in pain when you're doing that? And he would go, yeah, it hurts a lot. He said, you know, in the morning, it's incredibly difficult running the first 20 minutes, the pain. And he said, I just overcame the pain. And he said, the kids that he met in the cancer ward when he was going through treatment back in Vancouver initially, when he was 17 and 18 years old, it really, really affected him watching these youngsters younger than him fight cancer and in many cases not winning and passing away. And it deeply, deeply affected him. And he would say, I can stop running anytime I want. I can quit tomorrow if I want to. But people with cancer and those kids in that cancer ward, they can't stop fighting. So I'm not going to stop running. And he used that experience of his in the hospital to motivate him. And in the book, there were two nurses, one of them who, and they were both friends and still are, and they're up in their 80s, but one was the nurse who took care of him when his leg was first amputated. And she was the one who said to them, you can let this ruin your life, or you can make something out of it, and you can go out there and do something. And then the other nurse was the one who took care of him when he came home after he got sick, and was the spokesperson for the family for the next year. And both of them are very close to the family. But the second one, Allison Ince, gave me a letter, because I met with them several times when I was writing the book. Just give me insights to who Terry was. And the nurse that took care of him gave me a letter that Terry sent to her in January of 1980. It's a two-page letter, and it's absolutely amazing. And it's in the book, word for word. And he talks about, I'm so excited. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to run across Canada. And he thanks her for being the motivator to get that dream, to follow his dream, to work at it. By the way, he ran 3,000 miles before he started running, just learning how to run. And that letter is just so moving. And when you read it in Terry's words, saying, I'm going to run across Canada, and here's why I'm going to run across Canada. And both of those people, Allison Ince and Judith Ray, were just phenomenal. I can't thank them enough that the help that they gave me. Judith lives in Mission, and Allison lives in Surrey.
Here we are 43 years later. The Marathon of Hope has lived on. Fundraising effort that Terry couldn't carry on has carried on by the power of Canadians. Of all the places that you can be running or walking this year, Bill, where are you going to be?
This year, I've been there twice before. I haven't been there for a few years, but I'm going to be in Victoria. I lived in Victoria for 5 years when I first moved to the West Coast. They have an amazing organizational team over there. They have a statue at Mile Zero in Victoria, very similar to the statue that's Mile Zero in St. John's. He did make it coast to coast. So I'm really looking forward to that. And then they also do a head shave. And the first year I was there, it was really neat, because there was maybe 100 people there, but they were going to do a head shave fundraising, and maybe 4 or 5 people had showed up to get their hair cut. And I'm standing there thinking, this is before the run starts. Too bad there's not more people. Well, first one fire truck pulls up, then another fire truck pulls up, then another 4 fire trucks pull up from the different communities of Esquimalt, Victoria, Fairfield, Sydney. And I'm sure there's somebody left back at one of the stations, but there had to be 20 firemen all get off, come over, and all of them had raised money, and all of them had their head shaved for Terry. So I'm actually going to be shaving somebody's head this year. I haven't got much left. They'd save mine, but there's not that much left. And then on the day after the run, I'm actually I'm going to be at a place called Russell Books, which is the largest independent bookstore in Canada, in Victoria, doing a book signing. And it's really neat, because I like going back to Victoria, because I have so many friends there. And so many wonderful memories. I spent 5 years, I literally moved from 3 blocks from the baseball stadium in downtown Toronto. And 4 weeks later, I'm on the Haida Gwaii Islands cooking on a boat. By the way, I lied, I was never a chef. But I was cooking for 25 Americans who were salmon fishing and gourmet food. And I was the cook, showed up with a melon scooper and a New York Times cookbook. So I was still flying by the seat of my pants, and I still am.
If you're over in Victoria, join in the Terry Fox Run, and you can meet Bill and get a copy of the book signed the day after. Go to terryfox.org to find out where you can run, walk, or roll, and to raise money to help end cancer. Every dollar counts. And thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast, Bill Vigors.
Thank you very much, Bob, and have a wonderful day. And Bob, I'm joining you. Please, folks, join in the run this year. It's a big one.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan's KMT rejects alliance with anti-China parties. As Vice President Lai Ching-te of the Democratic Progressive Party maintains a comfortable lead in most opinion polls, some political commentators have suggested that his opponents join forces to defeat him in the 2024 election. Eric Chu wants consensus on China and constitutional reform before KMT can consider cooperating with other opposition parties. In Kyoto news, Japan, China spar over import ban after Fukushima water release. Tokyo will continue to demand Beijing take action based on scientific grounds, while it will keep providing appropriate information on the discharge that began on August 24th, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said during the ASEAN Plus 3 summit involving Japan, China, and South Korea held in Jakarta. China has strongly opposed Japan's handling of the wastewater and implemented a blanket ban on Japanese seafood imports in protest shortly after the discharge started. Tokyo has since urged Beijing to scrap it. In the Jakarta Post, hackers breach House of Representatives YouTube to promote online gambling. Unidentified hackers seized control of the official YouTube account of the House of Representatives and used the platform to post advertisements promoting online gambling. The hackers replaced the House logo as the channel's profile picture with an image of a golden slot machine with text written, "Slot Baris." They also posted multiple live-streamed videos showing online gambling apps with narration in Turkish in the background. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland leaders approve public drug use ban. State law must first change to enact. The emergency ordinance, approved 5-0 by the City Council on Wednesday, adds controlled substances to Portland's pre-existing prohibition on public alcohol use that carries a penalty of up to 6 months in jail or a $500 fine. Yet, Oregon law currently forbids cities and other local governments from regulating the consumption of street drugs, which voters decriminalized through Measure 110. Other intoxicants, such as beer or marijuana, remain illegal to use on Portland sidewalks or in city parks. In King 5, Joe Kennedy, football coach once fired for prayers, resigns after one game back at Bremerton. Kennedy won a U.S. Supreme Court case against the Bremerton School District in 2022 and was back on the football coaching staff this fall. Kennedy's case made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where in 2022 a 5-4 majority ruled in his favor. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote, "The best of our traditions counsel mutual respect and tolerance, not censorship and suppression, for religious and non-religious views alike." In the Times Colonist, amid forecast of financial uncertainty, BC Ferries seeks to buy 4 new electric vessels. It is forecasting financial uncertainty amid staffing shortages and rising costs. The $500 million for BC Ferries was part of a $2 billion surplus the province allocated to ministries and government-related bodies this year. The company has hired 1,200 employees in the past year, a net gain of 500 people. Plans to order 4 new island-class ferries have gone to the BC Ferries board, but no cost estimate was provided for the new ferries. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to people with disabilities in the workforce and employers who accommodate people with disabilities, because September is Disability Employment Month in BC. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
what you do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do, cause your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end, cause the rich men, north of rich men.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 10th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 10th of September in 1939, King George VI gave royal assent to Canada's declaration of war against Nazi Germany? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. It's the best way to keep up with thebreaker.news, while Facebook refuses to show Canadian news to Canadians because of the Trudeau Liberal government's Bill C-18. Also, for news as it happens, you can follow us on Twitter at thebreakernews. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.